This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Gothenburg, Sweden. Welcome to all regular and new listeners. RedIceCreations.com is our website, and that is the place to keep an eye on if you're, just like me, interested in all subjects related to alternative research. You can follow us on Twitter, on YouTube, sign up for our RSS feeds, both for the radio show and for our news. All information about this is available on the website. And if you like what we do and want more, consider signing up for a Red Ice membership and get full access to our archives. It's only 16 eurocents per day. And today we have author and researcher Freddy Silva with us on the line. Our theme today is sacred places, crop temples, and invisible temples. Freddy is behind the film Stairways to Heaven, The Practical Magic of Sacred Space, and the book Secrets in the Field. And hopefully you are aware of some of his research and work by now. If you're not, I recommend that you go to his websites and take a good look around for much more interesting material. CropCircleSecrets.org and InvisibleTemple.com are the websites you can take a look at. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Freddy Silva. It's great to have you here.
Hello, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for your time. We really appreciate it. There's so many interesting things I want to talk with you about today, but as a way of introduction, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and the research for listeners that might not be familiar with you and your work.
Sure. I seem to have started off very early. Around the age of three, I was drawing pyramids on pieces of paper, so I figured that my life was going to be very strange. And I always had a very deep interest in earth mysteries. I always was fascinated by ancient cultures. When I was a child, I used to play with dinosaur eggs when I was living in Portugal, of all places. And I sort of went into the design field for many years after college. I went into advertising for many years, became very successful. And then one day, while I was minding my own business, ironing a shirt in Chicago, I was watching something on television. And I don't know what it was because the sound was turned off. But it was this image of this incredible design in the middle of a wheat field. And I knew exactly what it was when I first saw it. And I can pretty much date the demise of my commercial career at that moment and my rising interest in crop circles and everything else to do with ancient sacred sites. And, of course, I went on to become, one of the leading researchers of crop circles, as well as the interaction between ancient sacred sites and consciousness. And here we are today.
How come you your career went downhill from that point? Did you just have to immerse yourself like 100% in this mystery of the crop circles?
I think you do. I had no idea at the time how much immersion you really have to do. But then again, I'm also a person that once I find a passion for something, I believe that in order to teach it properly to other people, assuming that there is something of benefit to others, that only by immersing yourself totally and looking at all sides of the equation to make sure that you see both sides of any argument, can you adequately be prepared to teach anything? Otherwise, you may as well just read a book and tell people about it. And that's not what I want to do. I really felt that in order to get to the heart of this mystery, I really had to just give up my job, dedicate my time to looking at things on the ground, talking to people on different sides of the fence and gaining a pretty balanced viewpoint of what really was going on. And I had no idea at the time how deep this whole investigation would become.
Did you move to the UK then, primarily because there's where the most of the crop circles are at this point, right?
Yeah, and I was living in America at the time, and it was taking up so much of my time going backwards and forwards. The only sensible thing to do was literally to move back full time, which I eventually did back in 1998, and then subsequently came back to the States to promote my book, which incredibly becomes a bestseller. It comes out the same day as the film Signs, which is an incredible coincidence.
Oh, really?
And I am not complaining. Huh. Yes, it was just a matter of literally sitting there in the middle of Alton Barnes, where I used to live, literally in the heart of the entire mystery. And there's so much mystery around there, not just because of the crop circles, but because I'm surrounded by some of the world's most incredible sacred sites. I mean, we have Stonehenge, Avebury, we have giant graves which date back to 8,000 BC. So when you have that kind of information at your disposal and you're able to go there, not just during the tourist season, but also in the fallow time of the year during winter when things are quiet, you really get a sense that the land talks back to you. And after a while, you do understand what the land meant to our ancestors and why they were so attached to it. Because you literally do go to these places and they talk back to you. They give you information. And that's when you realize that you are part of something much, much bigger.
Do you think everyone is open to that? Or do you think that only a few people are aware and kind of sensitive enough to pick up on this?
I think everyone is born with that ability. And I think at some point in life, we either make a conscious or an unconscious choice to either open up to the invisible universe or not. And part of that, of course, is to do with parents who, when you're 5 years of age, they'll smack you in the back of the head and tell you that, no, you're not talking to the fairies. And of course you are. I mean, kids, when they're that young, they still have one foot in the other world, and they're able to see and perceive things that adults can't because of all the conditioning that, of course, we get hammered with over the years. Mortgages and car insurance and jobs and careers. I mean, that takes its toll on the intuitive side of the human being. And we get so consumed by the left brain that we forget that there's a whole world out there that thousands of years ago, our ancestors, you know, they totally took it to be absolutely part of the everyday life. And that's how they lived their lives in perfect balance for so many thousands of years. And whereas today we can barely hold on to a civilization for more than 50 years without it imploding.
Well, that's a good point. Why do you think that we primarily, I guess, in the West have kind of veered away a little bit from this area? And just as you say, it seems to be that when we have this type of structure of society that we have, it seems to almost crumble, you know, all the time. We're trying to build empires in a way, but it doesn't succeed. Do you think it's because we don't incorporate more of the right brain think into this as well, or what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. It's also part of a bigger picture where human consciousness tends to change and evolve in periods of around 2,400 years. And if you look back through history, this is particularly so. And we just happen to be in a part of that block of history where we chose to stop working together and become very tribal. We've given away the power from the sacred feminine to the male-dominated side of life, and that becomes a very solar, very rigid, very linear type of thinking. And it gets us into all kinds of troubles, because when you think linearly, when you accept that life is goes along a certain direct line, you start missing out on the true fact that the universe does not work in straight lines. It works in circles. It works in cycles. And that's what our ancestors were able to differentiate from our culture, was the fact that everything has a cycle. Even the Celtic culture, you know, only less than 2,000 years ago, they understood that the life is cyclical. It goes around in circles and it comes back again and it rejuvenates every year. And we just keep losing track of this. I think the real rise of it really came with the rise of the Roman Catholic Church. And when they did away with the sacred feminine, they tried to impose this linear, fear-based culture that we're still living in today. And then we have the rise of the quantitative and qualitative side of life with Isaac Newton. Not that he was responsible, but the whole scientific quantitative side of life, something takes over. We become very rational. Everything has to be explained by weighing and testing and developing machines to test nature. And here's the funny part. Every time that science comes up with a new machine to test nature, they only end up validating what our ancestors knew 5,000 years ago. Yeah. So there is a lesson in that. And I think that's part of the cornucopia of how society has gone on this strange path of the left brain, this linear thinking, and it's got us into a very blind alley. And I think we come to realize that it doesn't work. And this is why I think we're seeing life and civilization, and particularly here in America, where I live now, we're beginning to see that empire building doesn't work. It gets you into a lot of trouble. And we're seeing a lot of change, especially with the new presidential election. We see a lot of hope here, a lot of change to realize we have to go back to a tribal society of cooperation, thinking in the round rather than thinking linearly, and accepting that there is a cycle of nature that we have to work with.
Just as you say, in one sense, people aren't, you know, happy, not spiritually fulfilled. But do you think that the time we have been in for, I don't know, the last, you know, almost 1,500 years or something like that, and that has fulfilled another purpose, that we've been going it through the scientific and kind of technological route for a specific type of discovery of nature and the universe, or has it all been a waste of time, so to speak?
I don't think it's ever a waste of time. I think it's all about the magic of being human. When we're a bunch of souls hovering around the universe and we decide to come down here and incarnate, it's by choice. And we come down here to have an experience. And I was having a question put to a friend of mine in England who happens to be one of the world's most profound psychics. I mean, even the police have a lot of respect for her. And she's a very self-effacing person. She doesn't take much seriously. And during one of our conversations, I was saying, what is the purpose to human life? And she said, what the universe tells me is that it's all about having an experience. It's not about right or wrong. It's not about doing certain choices. It's about having the experience and living it. And this whole concept that we've been down here for the last 1500 years, experiencing, being burned at the stake, being tortured, being subjected to a financial system that propagates itself at the expense of the public, It's all part of an experience of learning. And I think that there is now an understanding, I think culturally and shared over many, many centuries, that the system does not work. It only works for the benefit of very few people.
Yeah.
And I think you begin to see a reaction to that all over the world, and especially in Europe, where the recession is particularly hard hit, where people are beginning to question their position in life, their position relative to their families, their position to the environment, and also their relationship to the land. You see so many more thousands of people going to see ancient sacred sites, either consciously or just out of interest. And I think there's an awakening taking place. People are beginning to realize that something in the modern world has come to a complete stop. It doesn't make any sense. And they're seeking an alternative way to actually get back into connecting to something that is far, far bigger than them, to see if that perhaps makes sense. So I think this whole concept of going down this strange analytical, scientific, economic route has its purpose. Eventually people will realize that it doesn't work. The toys that you've been playing with have ceased to function. And now we're going to be coming up with new toys to make our lives more accessible.
So what do you think is the kind of the outcome of that? What do you think we need to do to find a new way out of this, so to speak?
Oh, I think you have to be honest with yourself and just recognize why you're here. You have to follow your own path. And the answer is very personal, as well as it is cultural. I think the answer is that we have to see and go back to examples from thousands of years ago of how our ancestors were able to conduct their affairs in perfect harmony and maintain civilizations going for 3,000 years in some cases without the whole thing falling apart. How did they get it right? And of course, if you look at how they got it right, it was about the communication to each other. It was about establishing a point of contact between people that was non-confrontational. It was not about possession. Not that we have to give all our possessions away, but it's about a non-competitive form of life. In other words, it's a non-competitive type of nature where we learn to work with each other in order to help each other. For example, you have something that I need and I have something that you need. Well, then let's trade and let's not try and just come up with these ridiculous economic systems to try and catch everybody out to make as much money as possible and capitalize on everything. I think the opportunistic and capitalistic side of nature has literally run its course, and it has nowhere else to go. We can't keep charting our progress on charts that keep telling us that every year our deposits are going up and our share prices keep going up. It's unsupportable. And I think if you look at the way that ancient cultures were able to maintain their system of cooperation, I think we find that the answers are all there.
Yeah, and even if we look at the money system itself, it's kind of an illusion. It's a false value system. It's pixels on a screen today, pretty much, and it isn't even backed up by a proper money reserve. We don't have to go into too much detail about this, but it just gives us that inclination that what we're dealing with right now is kind of more like an illusion than factual, actual, a value system, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, just to make the point very clear, a few years ago when I was closing a bank account and I was moving to England, I asked my bank teller to cash out my account. I mean, there's hardly anything in there. There's about $5,000. And they couldn't give me that in money. And I said, you've got to be joking. You've got a bank and you cannot give me $5,000 in cash. This is very, very strange.
They don't carry cash anymore, huh?
No, and even they said it was very unusual. They were all the tellers and the bank managers suddenly realized, we have a problem here. We actually have no hard currency in the bank vault. And we're not talking about a small bank. We're talking about a bank in Boston, and not exactly a small city either. So it is funny. The whole thing is quite an illusion.
Let's talk a little bit about our ancestors. I want to ask you, how far back do you go in your research, Freddie?
Oh, as far back as history will allow me. And which right now, given the new advantages that we have with modern methods of archaeology, because up to now, archaeology has been very limited in the way it conducts its affairs. So the more they're able to recognize that their systems are very limited, the more they're able to actually expand their understanding and especially their dating techniques. And recently, I was reading on Graham Hancock's website how a lot of new archaeological testing is now able to go back into at least 9,500 years of data to show temples which are now underwater, for example, which were covered over by the oceans at the time of a great flood, which he himself has made a very good point of conveying. And for me, it's about going back even further into history. Whether we're using normal techniques such as science or whether we're using psychic phenomena, for me, it doesn't really matter as long as the source is able to be validated in some way. And this is why I like to mix science and mysticism very carefully. So where science stops, I usually go and ask people who have a very good track record of working with psychic material to try and paint a picture of things that we cannot establish on a physical level. And I'm astonished sometimes by the people that I work with of how quickly, and I'm talking about within a couple of years, how their information is then validated by normal archaeological methods, and slowly the timelines are going back further and further and further. So at one point, only about 10 years ago, we probably couldn't date anything further than 8,000 BC. Well, now we're talking about human habitation on the planet Earth going back beyond 40,000 years. Mm-hmm. And for me, because I'm actually in the middle of a current project, which I can't mention much about, because I haven't yet covered all the bases yet. But I'm trying to basically figure out what's happened in terms of temple building in the last 26,000 years, which essentially is an entire cycle of the Earth's precessional wobble. And essentially, that's about seven phases of human consciousness development. I want to find out what was happening before the flood. And like I said, people like Graham Hancock are slowly beginning to fill in the pieces by showing that there were temples, huge temples, off the coasts of Japan, India, and also in the Mediterranean, which very clearly preceded the catastrophic event around about 9,600 BC. And if I can try and fill those gaps, I can start showing how we haven't actually gone up. Sorry, we haven't actually gone up in the world in terms of human development. We've actually gone down because the people who were building places like Teotihuacan, the Great Pyramids, they had an understanding which was far and above ours only until a few years ago. In fact, I was reading something on NASA many years ago that talked about how they were astonished how the Egyptians, by putting the numbers of the Earth in the Great Pyramid, their measurement of the Earth was actually very close to how they were able to perceive the measure of the Earth using modern technology. Mm-hmm. And this is NASA now validating the ancient Egyptians. So we haven't actually gone up. We've actually gone down from a high culture. And it's only now that we begin to realize that we need to go and bottom out and start going back up to where they were 8,000 years ago.
But at the same time, though, it feels like we have been on this kind of reverse bell curve, if you know what I mean. It seems to be that we're rediscovering this now, which means that we actually are on our way upward, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very nicely coincides with the age of Aquarius, if you're into that thinking, the second coming of Christ, 2012 for the Mayans. We're reaching a pivotal stage where we begin to wake up and realize that people before us knew a lot more about the way the universe works, and which brings us back, of course, to how they were able to work with nature in a very harmonious way.
You mentioned science and mysticism before. Do you think that they actually meet at some point if we think about a future science, possibly, if we can, you know, keep an open mind and if we actually allow ourselves to go where the evidence leads? Do you think that these two actually will meet at some point?
Oh, I think they will. They really are. It's just that some people, especially if they're very orthodox, they tend to cling on to ideas because it's, to some degree, it's about ego. It's about protecting your position within a certain community. The UFO community is a very prime example of this, where they, the scientific community, the orthodox scientific community, will negate any study of UFOs. And yet those people who actually have dared to step outside the box and look at the evidence supporting UFO phenomenon, and particularly from the eyewitness accounts made by military people, very sane and rational aircraft pilots, people like that, they realize that there is something out there that we cannot account for in a rational means. And they are making huge strides in basically bridging the bridge, bridging the gap between science and mysticism, and recognizing that the things that these crazy people are talking about actually make a lot of sense. And I think it just requires a little shift in your ego to try and accept that perhaps the information that you were given and that you staked your reputation on perhaps was not complete. And with the incoming of new information, perhaps it's possible to shift one's position in order to accommodate a new idea. I mean, I do this all the time with crop circles. I mean, I thought I knew everything about crop circles 10 years ago. And sometimes I've had to eat my own hat and apologize to people and say, actually, I didn't, because I now have new information, which allows me to further modify my theories, which and that's absolutely fine. I believe to have been absolutely correct at the time because of the available information. Now, with the new information that I have at my disposal, I'm able to make a slightly different view. That doesn't make me wrong. It just makes me right according to the amount of information.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about in regarding to how one shifts one attitude towards kind of history and life. But was there something more you wanted to say before we got cut off there?
Yeah, I was remembering a case back at the turn of the century where there was a man called Leadbeater who had an incredible psychic ability to actually see atoms. I mean, he could literally stop atoms in front of his eyes, and he was able to draw the carbon atom and all kinds of other crazy things in front of him. And scientists in the Victorian era thought he was absolutely mad. Well, about 40 or 50 years later, science develops the electron microscope, and they were able for the first time in modern history to peer into the world of the subatomic realm, and they could see atoms and electrons and neurons, and they were able to freeze them, and they were able to draw them. And what was startling was that they were able to draw them in exactly the same configurations that Leadbeater had once done back in the Victorian era. And this is a wonderful example of science always playing catch up to the metaphysical. And it's an example really well for remembering.
Absolutely. And in regards to kind of shifting one's attitude, let's say, towards history and life in general, do you think it's more about new information that you mentioned in the external sense, or you also think there has to be some kind of internal awakening going on at the same time?
Well, I think it's both. I think you have to, especially if you're coming from a materialistic, rationalistic point of view. And I see that with a lot of my friends, for example, who, you know, they don't really understand what it is I do for a living. And I try to put it to them in their particular language that, you know, we have been brought up within a certain paradigm. I mean, a lot of us in the West have been brought up within a certain religious understanding, mostly the Roman Catholic belief, which has a very particular and very narrow dogma to teach. It does not allow a lot of understanding outside some particular regimented way of seeing the world. And using that just as a prime example, if we can just then read about other information that other people have made, we can then see that perhaps the story that we've been given is not exactly either true or full. And usually it's the latter. I mean, perception is one's perception. It's not about being right or wrong. It's just how people perceive things. So if we suddenly open ourselves to new ideas, new possibilities and new research, and we're able to accept that as fact, then it's up to us to then take that understanding and move beyond our conditioning to accept that perhaps we have been led to believe that, you know, the color red is actually blue, when in fact it was red all along. And perhaps it may even be the color yellow, for all we know. So once you put yourself in that situation, it's almost like trying to cross a river. You're in the middle of the river, and you're being bombarded by rocks and pebbles, and there's lots of water swirling around you. Once you're in the middle of the river and you've got all of this water coming around you and all of these stones, you can start playing with that information, and you can choose to go back to the shore where you came from and live your life perfectly happy and the way you've been, or you can make a journey and take all of that new information that you're picking up across the river, and you get to the other side, and you look back to the other shore, and you realize, I'm standing on a place which is very, very different from where I was only a few hours ago. And let's see what happens on this side of the shore. And I guarantee to anybody who's listening that if you just accept that for 1 second and take in new information, and you certainly don't have to, you know, accept everything that isn't written down in books and on the internet, right? Because there is a lot of nonsense out there. Just take stuff that rings a bell inside you, that's something that really speaks to your heart. And at that moment, your view of the world starts to open up, and you'd be amazed where it takes you. Mm-hmm. And once you get your panorama is very, very different, and it's also very free. And once you have that freedom, you can explore to your heart's content. And once you start exploring, your personal life starts taking on a whole new and very personal meaning. And I believe that's where we really are striving to get to. We're trying to find our own way in the world, not how people have taught us. And that includes me. I mean, people can read my book and they'll say, well, you know, you're a great guru or et cetera. And I'll say, well, actually, I'm not a guru. I'm just giving you the information from my perspective and my experience. And it works for me. And if it works for you, so much the better. But I can tell you that right now, 10 years from where I started, my life is 180 degrees different from where it was. And I'm very glad for it, because I now see the universe as a very much bigger and wider organism than I was led to believe.
And I guess also to add to that you have a more sense of purpose to things. You know, in one way, it feels like the society, which very much to me at least, has this kind of collectivist point of view thing going on. They kind of frown almost on the individual level to all of this. And I guess that for you, and I would say for me as well, that it is more about nowadays find your purpose and your place in the world as compared to before this. What would you say to that?
Oh, I would agree. I would totally agree. And slowly the paradigms are shifting. And I think as people become more confronted with the information that we're putting out, the more they either, well, usually the reaction is that they basically tear you down. You know, it's so much easier to destroy something than it is to create in this world. So the first reaction they'll have is they'll try a witch hunt. They'll put you down. They'll burn you at the stake, you know, figuratively speaking. Which actually shows that we've actually moved a long way from 400 years ago when they literally were burning people like us at the stake. So well, I guess we've improved. Once they're confronted with it, they have a choice. They can either stay where they are, or they can think about it. They can mull about the situation for a while, and then they can also accept it. And I'm seeing certainly in the thousands of people that I speak to around the world each year, I see this. People do think about it. Now, I don't confront people with anything.
Right.
I just go and say, you know, what I'm about to tell you this evening is not the truth. And of course, everybody goes, oh my God. I said, no, I'm not going to tell you the truth, because that's my truth. And it's different from your truth. What I'm going to tell you are the facts. Now, you can agree or disagree with the facts, but they are facts, and you can check them out for yourself. And I find 9 times out of 10 that people will come around to a different way of thinking. And it's very good to actually take that approach. It's non-confrontational. You're giving people a choice, and you let them do the work for themselves. And I think that empowers people. They're not being told what to do. And when people are self-empowered, they get a sense that they are totally in control of their lives. And that makes a huge difference.
Well, I'd agree with that. And I guess that you're saying as well that it's not kind of worth going into those kind of battles with people about viewpoints in regards to life. It's better to leave that to the side and just present the information for what it is, right?
Exactly. And the skeptics are a strange group of people. Psychop, for example, I mean, they have been debunking crop circles since the moment they were advertised back in 1991. And also, the problem is that they're carrying this wonderful witch hunt against all of us, myself included, without actually having any foundation for their argument. And I'm saying, well, first of all, you don't have access to all the information. The way that you're portraying the subject of crop circles is, first of all, factually incorrect. So you need to get your facts right. And second of all, what does it matter to you if we happen to be all deluded? Why don't you just leave us alone and be happy with our self-delusion? What is it any of interest to you? Get on with your own life. You don't believe in crop circles. We do. So why do you spend so much time and energy trying to tell us that we're deluded? leave us alone with our own self-delusion. We're quite happy. Well, I've never understood people like that.
I actually think it comes from the idea that they're actually afraid of people seriously looking into it because it makes them uncomfortable, so they have to prove that it's not true. Because what if it is, right? That means that they have to change their worldview. That's how I view it, at least. But I don't know. Could be wrong.
Absolutely, absolutely. But still, it's so much effort to go into.
Yeah, of course.
You can just walk away and laugh at people like us and go on in your merry life and have an ice cream down the road. But they don't. they really have a wonderful fear about them, and it makes me laugh.
That's right, that's right. I want to ask you a little bit about, I guess, the roots of civilization as well. And maybe if you can touch upon the idea of where you think our ancestors got the knowledge from to begin with.
Oh God, you know, I've wrestled with this for such a long time. You know, I was studying Atlantis and the origins of Atlantis, and was there Atlantis? Was there not? Was it an allegory? Was it a metaphor? I don't think it was a metaphor. I think it was real. I think we've had civilizations here on Earth for millions of years. And when I was young, and I'm talking about 3 years of age, when I was messing about with my little dinosaur eggs in Portugal, I began to dream that I was perfectly comfortable with walking with dinosaurs. And it's only recently that I began to remember these dreams. That I remember very happily living with dinosaurs, having little pets. I also used to think that I was much taller. I was a giant back in those days. Now, you know, 40 years later, doing all my research and coming across giant graves and also living among them in Britain, they're still there today. excuse me. There are many places in the British Isles and in the Celtic lands where very, very tall, 12-foot people have been dug up from giants' graves. So I now know that a giant race of people did exist on the Earth, and that's been scientifically proven. And now we've also discovered, quite incredibly, and not far from me, in a riverbed in Texas, there were dinosaur footprints encased in mud next to human footprints.
Yes.
And of course, the skeptics came out and said, oh, it's a fraud, blah, blah, blah. So they took a crane and they dug the riverbed that went into this riverbank, which of course is, you know, 30 feet below and underneath a riverbank. And the footsteps continued well into the actual hill, which means, of course, it wasn't a man-made creation. This was actually a physiological feature, which proved very clearly that humanoids and dinosaurs worked together. So the origins go back much, much further into prehistory than we want to accept. Now, there was another interesting group of people that I bumped into on my journeys. And they wrote an incredible book called Two Thirds, A History of Our Galaxy. It's written as an allegorical tale about how life originated on Mars. And then because the whole system collapsed because of environmental degradation, we suddenly shipped our bodies over to the Earth. And I have to say, it's a very strange book, but there's also a lot of science in it. And I recommend it with apprehension because people that I recommend it to, they'll send me hate mail and say, you know, I suffered through 700 pages of that book. It did my head in, but it was interesting. And I said, it is. It's an interesting concept of how maybe part of us were colonized from a planet that was dying. And of course, we look at Earth today and it's encroaching deserts, and we look at how the Earth is starting to resemble parts of Mars, and I wonder if there isn't some truth to this. This is, of course, going back into millions of years. I still do believe that part of the culture that we inherited in terms of temple making actually came from a pre-diluvial civilization that literally did go under the water at 9600 BC, which has now been proved by various scientific teams around the world, not just through hypothesis, but through hard facts of looking at temples 200 feet below the ocean. So I think that the places like the pyramids, Teotihuacan, the places in Peru, all the mounds across the world, they all share the same technology. They all work with manipulating magnetics. They work with the same measurement systems, the same geometries, the same sonic principles, and all of their cultures all talk about these temples having been built by a race of very tall beings that survived a flood, and they came from different parts of the world. And I found that in Portugal, I found that in Ireland, in Britain, in America, in Southern America, in Japan. It's the same people giving the surviving human races the same information for exactly the same reasons. So we're talking about something which is very, very ancient indeed.
So potentially a race of giants here. Do you think that they were responsible for a lot of the megalithic sites, or do you still think this is done by more closely related to the modern human being that did these monuments or constructed these monuments?
I think it was integration of both. I think that there was a dying culture that genetically was literally just dying off. And again, I point back to all of these skeletons that keep getting found in giants' graves in the Celtic world, principally in the British Isles, which measure between 9.5 to 12 feet tall. A lot of them have elongated skulls, as did the ancient pharaohs of Egypt. Akhenaten was one of the last pharaohs to have an elongated skull, as was Tutankhamun. And when I was referring this and cross-referencing it with the psychic material, it turns out that we were dealing with a dying race of people who basically were the ancestors of the survivors from Atlantis. So this makes absolutely sense, where we have a priestly caste of people who survived the catastrophe. They brought back to the mainland the ideas of working with and rejuvenating civilization, working with the principles of manipulating natural forces to create temples that would allow people to reconnect back with cosmic principles. And then they work with normal, average human beings like us, although I am 6'5", so I may be a little bit different. And I think it was a combination of both. They recognized that their race was not going to survive. They had to pass on the information. But I do believe, based on a lot of the myths or traditions around the world, that a lot of the people who actually physically put the rocks up, and these are very, very big rocks. We're talking about, for example, in Lebanon, we talk about Baalbek. I mean, some of those rocks are 350 tons.
Yes.
And the only thing that made any sense to me was that people of very, very large stature would have been able to work with that kind of size, because it doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense if you're working with a culture that's bigger than us, then suddenly the pieces fit together. If we have a race of people that are bigger, then of course they're going to build things which are also bigger, because it's relative to them and their anatomy. And if you look at some of the myths behind Stonehenge, we look at how a race of giants, giant priests, had an understanding of manipulating magnetic lines of energy and also sound. And it's the same in Egypt. And a lot of those large rocks came from very far away. Now, if you look at the type of rocks that they chose principally to build the core of those monuments, they are very high in quartz. And quartz is a highly programmable material. It is also subjective to electromagnetism and sound. And if you find the right sonic frequency of those rocks, you can get them to levitate. Now, this might be a little bit strange, but I point to an experiment that was done at Princeton University only 20 years ago, where they did take a small rock and they threw ultrasound at the rock, and the rock levitated in the laboratory. So suddenly we again see science backing up the psychic material and backing up the myths at the same time. And I believe that a lot of these places were constructed, the old ones, especially the very, very old temples dating back to 6,000 and 5,000 BC, that they were constructed principally by very tall people, priests who had the understanding of these principles, and they could harness them to create these incredible structures. But eventually, as we get down to about 2000, 1000 BC, then people like us took over the temple building process, because we do know from archaeological remains that these temples were constructed across, say, 4,000 year periods. Mm-hmm. They kept being added to. And again, that makes perfect sense logically.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about that later on in regards to, the quartz and how this has been built and the electromagnetic components or properties of many of these sites. But one thing I want to ask you here right away is if you think that the Earth in some way has been damaged or hurt by this cataclysm, and if some of these sites actually are kind of an attempt to balance the Earth again in an electromagnetic way?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because that's a project I'm working on right now.
There we go, yeah.
Began to work backwards, I began, reacquainting myself with the knowledge that I've had since I was a child. And when I got stuck with crop circles and understanding how they work and how they were working with sound and magnetism principally, I then went back in time and recognized the connection between them and the ancient sacred sites. And I recognized that there was a connection. And, I wanted to find out how this all came to be. Why did they build In fact, why did they have this obsession with ancient sacred sites and building them all across the world? Because there are tens of thousands of these places. And over the course of 15 years, I've traveled to a lot of these places around the world, and I began to look at them, make notes, and recognize that there's a pattern evolving, that they're all built for the same purposes. They're all built strategically to mark the node points of the Earth's magnetic grid. They were all built for the purpose of A, healing, B, heightened states of awareness, and C, to also manipulating the local energy field. And I wondered, perhaps, if this was a survival technique of a dying culture that was trying to rebuild the temple building process across the world in order to revitalize the Earth energy grid. And like I said, so far, I'm only halfway into this project so far, but I have evidence to believe that this is actually so. It was the whole temple building process across the world, of which the crop circles are an inherent part of, by the way, was an effort to try and create these portals across the face of the Earth as an insurance policy so that we as a race could understand the coming cycles of change and be better prepared to accept them and deal with them when they came. Because the cycles are inevitable. They're part of the Earth's cycle of movement. We just have to work with them because we are basically riding on the back of this enormous organism. And I believe very much that these portals were put all around the world for us to connect into as that insurance policy. And the more I look into them, the more it seems to be coming true.
Very interesting. And when you address this idea of the circles or the cycle of time again, I'm thinking about that we potentially are coming to the close again of the great year, and that we potentially again are at the door, at the threshold of another kind of cataclysmic event. Do you think that's true or not? There's a lot of people speculating about that. Of course, tying it into 2012 and all that. What's your thoughts about all that?
It's hard, principally because a lot of the experts that I've talked to regarding 2012, none of them really seem to agree when 2012 is going to be. And it really comes down to the complete change of calendars, counting systems, and so forth. So there is a little bit of deliberation. And yet the deliberation really centers on a possibility that 2012 really has a 120-year span either side of 2012, depending on who you talk to. And I believe there may be some truth to this. I think that things down here on Earth do not happen very literally. They happen very slowly and gradually. And I believe we've been in 2012 for the last 300 years. All the events that are leading up to this date. I mean, let's just accept for argument's sake that 2012 is going to be a pivotal moment. We'll just agree on that for the sake of argument. We have been leading up to this moment, and you can see how everything seems to be changing, moving, and shifting towards this date. And I'm of a firm belief that every 2,400 years or so, we do go through this process of change where suddenly things do fall apart, and we as a race have a possibility of altering our perception and going to have another experience. And if you look at the way that the temple building process was clustered, this is very much true, because the last great temple building process literally happened around 2500 BC. Now, you fast forward 4,000 years from that, and we're pretty close to that date right now. If you go back from 2500 BC for another 4,000 years, you get yet another large temple building period. And this is part of the project that I'm working on right now, to see how we could actually better predict the new temple building period and the new change in consciousness. And the crop circles fit very nicely into this new pattern. So while we're not actually going on the land building temples, someone else is doing it for us in order for us to go and into these portals to understand the change that is coming. So if you accept that the crop circles are part of the new cycle of change, then we are already into that cycle. But I don't believe that anything major is going to happen on 2012 unless there's a massive amount of people in the world that want a change to happen. And this is all about mass perception. If a mass amount of people want a problem to happen, it will manifest because of the laws of manifestation, the laws of intent. We saw this back in the Middle Ages when a predominant amount of people in Europe were thinking very negatively about the devil and life coming to an end. And lo and behold, suddenly you have virtually every city in Europe being razed to the ground by fires. We then get massive plagues, which decimate half of the population of Europe. And that's basically what happens when a mass amount of people hold a certain idea to be true. You have a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the same thing will happen for 2012. If we hit a critical mass of people who want something bad to happen, it will happen. But on the other hand, I want to believe that we literally are going through a window of time where 2012 literally marks a pivotal moment where all the forces of the universe and the solar system and human consciousness are geared up to make that change quick, rapid, and painless. Hmm. Now, after 2012, the forces of the universe and the window of opportunity now starts to close a little bit. And for the next 200 years of our history, we will still have the opportunity to reach that critical mass where we want something positive to happen. But we will be going against the flow of the universe. And then 200 years from now, we'll probably find that if we haven't hit the critical mass, we're going to be stuck with this male-dominated, logical, rational, scientific viewpoint for another 4,000 years. And I, for one, do not want to be here when that happens. I would rather have the male-female balance come back again into life, which I believe is where the next level of experience is due.
You know, I think this, in a while here, we want to begin rounding up our first hour. It's just going so quickly, and so many things I want to address with you more. But I want to run this by you again, or another question here about catastrophe, and if you think that this is actually something that's being kind of enforced or encouraged by the, what I like to call, the propaganda machine, considering the number of films we have on catastrophe. There are two 2012 films coming out now, a film called Knowing, and this is, seems to be kind of injected into the mainstream at this point in time. Do you think that will also actually, in one way, help to give focus and intention to catastrophe and tying this together with the period that we're in right now?
My God, I hope not. If it's true, I'm going to buy myself a Porsche. I'm going to die very happy. It's hard to say. Really, I think you have to understand the motivation behind the people that do this. And having worked in advertising for many years, it's given me a certain psychology of the human mind and how it can be used for right reason or for wrong reason. There are many people that work within the film industry that are doing this purely for commercial and artistic reasons. And catastrophes sell very well in Hollywood. Yes. I mean, we as human beings are naturally drawn to things breaking down. So we'd love to go and see a book about, a film about things dying on 2012 and mass annihilation. I think that there's this inherent self-destruct button that we have as human beings. So part of it is pure entertainment. Whether people take that in or not when they go home and they leave the cinema, it's hard to say. Hopefully they'll see it for what it is, as pure entertainment, and leave it alone. But then again, you have to wonder. Back in the after the Second World War, there were many industrial military complexes that were built, and specifically in America, where the military and commercial interests got together and tried to basically form and shape people's opinion of how to buy things and how to shape their perception of how the universe works by infiltrating the media, by having ghostwriters paid by the industry to write very pro-industry articles. It's still happening today with the medical industry. There was a article in the New York Times only yesterday discussing how it's been discovered how the medical industry is paying people to ghostwrite articles which debunk any naturopathic remedies and put forward not only medicines which are pro-science, but also very dangerous to people to begin with. So there is that aspect that people are infiltrating Hollywood and the media to put in these catastrophic elements and articles and films in order to get people to stay in a fear mode so they can control us. And I think there is a lot of truth to that as well.
Freddie, to round things up here for this first hour, tell us about your websites again, your book and your DVD, so people know where to go and what you have available for us out there.
Absolutely. If you want to know a very, very wide idea on crop circles and what's happening and what they're doing, I have a crop circle site called CropCircleSecrets.org. and you'll be there for days, I guarantee it. There's also a book on the subject, which I'm reliably told by many thousands of people that it's the Bible on the subject, which I'm very proud of. And it's called Secrets in the Field, and you can get that on my website, and there's lots of special offers that go with that that you won't find anywhere, which is good for people that are struggling in this economy, including me. And if you want to go into sacred space in the wider context, then obviously invisibletemple.com is the place for you.
Excellent. Links to this will be up on our website, redicecreations.com, so you can click through easily from there. Stay with us, Freddie, and we'll be back after this break. Join us in our members area as we discuss places of power, crop temples, sound and light. We'll begin to talk about Catholic suppression of this knowledge that we've been discussing. The Gothic cathedrals, the kings and elites, power corruption, and how ancient sites seem to have been plugged shut and closed down anyway. We talk about intent as an electromagnetic tool, alchemy, the universal consciousness, kinematics, has Jenny, frequency, quartz, crystal, computers, different kinds of stone and rock, and how it affects human consciousness. We also discuss Freemasons, Knights Templar, the Vatican, the Watchers, or the ancient gods, and we round things up by breaking down the purpose and the mystery of crop temples or crop circles. So do join us at redicecreations.com. R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com is the website. Click on members and tune in, or click on sign up to get instant access. It's only 16 euro cents per day. We have a jam-packed schedule ahead of us with Freeman, Catherine Austin Fitz, Philip Villan on the Vatican and the murder of Roberto Calvi, Rand Flemmath on Atlantis, Bob or Robert Dean on E.T., we have Dominic Orbeck on reptilian marketing versus the heart-brain model. We also have Marta Andreasen, the member of the European Parliament, coming on the program talking about her book Brussels Laid Bare. This is an excellent follow-up to the recent program that we did with David Icke and MEP Nigel Farage on the corruption of the EU. We also have Sam Semir Osmanagic on the Bosnian Pyramids, an update from him, and Tessa Dick. She's the wife of sci-fi author Philip K. Dick, who was behind The Blade Runner, Minority Report, Valis, A Scanner Darkly, and many more classics. But now, members, you're up for a real treat as we continue in Hour 2 with Freddie Silva.